Hello, friends, and welcome back to Lingering on the Lectionary, where we reflect on the life of the churches, the local academy, and the rhythm of the church's liturgy. Thanks for being here. Today, I talk with Dr. Greg Goswell about his extensive work in biblical theology, canon studies, and the paratextual features of the Bible. Thanks for listening. Well, welcome, Greg. Thanks for joining us. This is early evening for me, early morning for you, navigating the logistics with Australia.
No, thank you for that. It's good to be here.
Yeah, today we're going to discuss some of your work in canon studies, hermeneutics, and biblical theology. But as we begin our discussion, could you tell us a little bit about your teaching and research areas currently to kind of set our stage for our time today?
No, Chad, it's great to be with you. It's lovely to finally meet through these technical means. I'm the academic dean and lecturer in Old Testament at Christ College. It's a Presbyterian institution. It's in Sydney, Australia. And yes, I'm glad we could coordinate the times. Having a globe is really kind of gets in the way of these kind of conversations. So it's good to be here. I regularly teach Hebrew, a range of exegesis units, bachelor level, master's level. I've got doctoral students. Some of my students are preparing for Presbyterian ordained ministry. And thankfully, because like you, I'm interested in paratext, and we'll talk about what on earth that is, but my research interests can range over the Old Testament and the New Testament. I'm just someone who needs variety. I kind of get bored easily. So I mostly write journal articles because that enables me to kind of keep on changing topics and things like that. Every now and again, I'm kind of lured or tempted to write a book. So that's kind of me and what I'm like.
Do you think there are some unique challenges or opportunities to doing theological education there in Australia as opposed to maybe in Europe or an American context?
Yeah, opportunities. There's certainly challenges. We all find challenges. You know, our higher education system is really heavily regulated by the government. So it's a massive kind of accreditation compliance kind of load that we have. Our institution, we're accredited through the Australian College of Theology. We're trying to become a university. We've become a university college, but we were trying to become a specialised university, and that is just such a challenging process in Australia. You've got so many universities, which is great in America, and but the Australian system seems different. And they seem to forget we're kind of, in a sense, competing globally, you know what I mean? Kind of, so that's part of our challenge. It just takes a lot of work to keep an institution going here in Australia. But we've got wonderful students, and I find great joy in teaching and the things that I'm doing.
When you think about your student body, are most of the students training for ministry, or are they doing some other type of education with theological components?
No, it's theological, but only maybe a third or less of our students are thinking of ordained ministry. They're thinking of a whole lot of things. Which is great, and we really are keen to equip people from a whole lot of different types of churches. You know, we've got our own focus, but we try to be generous, and we're really trying to build everybody up and help everybody. You know, so it's a lovely atmosphere in which to work. Really,
we already talked a little bit before about the challenges for being in the academic community from Australia is showing up to a North American conference is quite a feat. Anytime I bump into an Australian friend, I know he's embarked on an epic journey to be there.
Yeah, it's like that. Yes, it's a long haul flights. You know, like I'm not really all that keen on doing that. Yeah. So it's great having this opportunity to talk.
Yeah, that works. Yeah. Well, last year you published a book called Text and Paratext, Book Order, Title, and Division as Keys to Biblical Interpretation with Lexham. So as we get started, let me ask you this. What would you say are some of the core claims you make in this book? What is a paratext and how could it be significant for our Bible reading?
Yeah, this was a book that Lexan invited me to kind of write. And Chad, thank you to you personally for the help and encouragement you gave me at the book proposal stage. I really appreciate that. But yes, this mysterious thing called paratext. And now this refers to when we look at our Bible, something which is staring us in the face, but we may not kind of notice it until it's pointed out. And that's all the way in which the biblical text is packaged. And so paratext, I define it as everything in the Bible apart from the words. So all those things are joined to the text, framing the text, but not strictly the words. And I love to bamboozle people by saying I'm an expert in everything in the Bible apart from the words. so that's the paratext. So what we're talking about is the order of the biblical books, the different names that have been assigned to the books, and also the different ways in which the books are internally divided. We're thinking of chapters and paragraphs and things like that. And because they are so closely connected to the text but not text, they frame the text, whether Bible readers notice it or not, it really does influence reading. And another way of putting it, every Bible's a study Bible. You know, it's got a built-in commentary. And you and I very much believe that often that's a very helpful commentary. This is ancient readers framing the text and seeking to assist future readers in really understanding what the Bible's saying. So that's what paratext is, yeah.
Yeah, I like the point that you make, and you just mentioned it, that every Bible is a study Bible. And we typically think of study Bibles as the ones that give us a lot of aids in reading. But if a reader, a modern reader, is holding a Bible in their hands, there's a host of paratextual features that are necessary to present that text to us. As we've talked about, these features are beside the text, but they're far from beside the point, because they always impact in some way the way that we perceive what we're actually reading, what we're holding for. So as someone's kind of grappling with that context or that concept, what would you say are some examples of like paratext in a modern, like a modern book when we're holding a modern Bible? And how would that be? Are those the same features, or is an ancient text doing something radically different? What would you say are some of the main similarities and differences are there?
Well, some of the features in our Bible are fairly recent. But if we're thinking of the medieval chapters, for example, that we're familiar with, and in the case of the New Testament, you know, it's only from the Reformation that we have verse divisions in the New Testament, like the verse divisions in the Old Testament are much more ancient, Masoretic, you know, 9th century AD and things like that. So our Bibles are very much a mixture. They preserve some ancient features, like the Old Testament verses, not verse numbering, but the verse divisions of the Old Testament, but other things comparatively recent. Yes, yeah, so quite mixed. And in terms of book order, of course, Old Testament, with the Jews, our Old Testament's based on the Hebrew Aramaic Old Testament, and yet the way the books are arranged is very much influenced by the Greek, the later Greek canonical tradition. So in lots of ways, I've described the Old Testament as it's presented to us as like a halfway house. Both the Hebrew canonical traditions, the Greek canonical traditions have both very much fed into the Bible that we have. So it's an odd amalgam in lots of ways, but what that does is that lots of different kinds of ancient readers have had input, often helpful input, into our reading of the Word. We're not the first people to read the Bible. And if we just look at the Bible itself in our hands, we actually discover that when we begin to notice some of these features. Yeah, people have been here before us. They've left traces of their own reading in this kind of packaging we're talking about, book order, book division. And so here's a commentary. It's basically free. It comes with us with a Bible. Commentaries are pretty expensive things, but we've got this kind of free inbuilt commentary that we can make use of. We don't have, and because it's commentary and not text, we're allowed to agree and disagree. Mm-hmm. But it's certainly inviting us to consider. This is a way in which we can have, another way I put it, we can have fellowship with dead people. We're interacting with ancient readers mm-hmm. when we're noticing how books, you know, what titles are given to books, how the flow of the biblical text is broken up by paragraphs and other things like that. We're having fellowship with other readers who reverenced and loved this text like we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that emphasis you have on these paratextual features connecting us to communities of readers in those.
Exactly.
And then one of the things that even just we can see this in our with modern books, sometimes I illustrate this with students and think of and just ask, hold up my Bible that I use in class and say, well, what is this telling me? And they're at first they're confused because like the Bible's closed and I'm just holding it up. They're like, what are you talking about? I was like, what from looking at this particular copy of this Bible, what can you tell about what I believe about this? You know, and then it starts clicking, like, well, there's a ribbon in it, so it's for repeated reading. It's, you know, the little fake gold on the pages, you know, it's the person who did that clearly believes that it's somehow valuable or sacred. Mm. I remember being in the bookstore when my daughter was 2 or 3, and I picked up like a classic, maybe it was like Moby Dick or something. And I picked it up and she saw the cover and she looked at the, you know, touched the ribbon and said, oh, this is a Bible. And I thought that was interesting because she had picked up on the paratextual features, and she picked up on the fact that this was being presented as a valuable, important text. And of course, for her, the one that she had seen like that was a Bible. I just thought that was an interesting way, and it kind of illustrates what you're arguing here is that paratextual features represent. You emphasize this a few times, interpretive possibilities for us to consider. Mm. And if we never notice the paratext, we might not realize how big of an influence it's actually having on us as readers.
And we need those alternatives and other ways of thinking offered to us. We get locked in our own time, you know what I mean? So if we can listen to voices from other times, that can actually refresh our own interpretation, maybe challenge our own interpretation at times too. But all that's extremely healthy. Yeah.
Yeah. You say in your conclusion of the book, you say we misuse the biblical paratext if it is never questioned or subject to evaluation. So what do you mean by that kind of statement?
Well, if we're looking at the Bible, sometimes we might want to disagree with some of the judgments made. An example, and I know you've done studies in Ezra and Nehemiah too and published there. Ezra and Nehemiah, is that a great name for the book? Because it does give the impression, the false impression, that this book's about Ezra and it's about Nehemiah, like it's mm-hmm. highlighting the role of leaders. When we look at the book and all these lists of names, it has this popularist orientation. You know, the book is about what the people achieve and what they fail to achieve. You know, at the end of Ezra and Nehemiah, chapter Nehemiah 13, it's the people's failure, not the leader's failure. So it's very much highlighting the importance of all the little people who make up the people of God. That's his focus, not a leader focus. So it's an unhelpful name. Another example I give is in the book of Esther. The really tiny last chapter, chapter 10, only 3 verses. Someone did this. I suspect this is a conspiracy theory, but let's make this chapter really tiny so Esther doesn't appear. You know, mm-hmm. Esther's been kind of edited out of the final chapter, so to speak, by really making, the climax or the final chapter, just these 10 verses, which featured Mordecai and Ahasuerus. Mm-hmm. But poor old Esther's kind of been left in chapter 9. So was that people kind of feeling slightly uncomfortable with how important Esther is in the book? But other people, of course, they call it Esther. They're foregrounded, the initiative, the important role of Esther in the rescue of the Jews there. So sometimes different features of the paratext, in a sense, argue against each other. There's a couple of examples, where perhaps we want to push back, like only after we've considered, only after our own, we've been stimulated to think about these issues because through the paratext, but sometimes we might want to push back.
Yeah, and interrogate them. I like that example because two very prominent paratexts, the title calling it Esther, and then some of the paragraph divisions highlighting Mordecai. So in a positive sense, that could help us see, okay, this book called Esther has quite a bit about Mordecai in it. And then as a reader and interpreter, we still have the work to do to think, what is the message of this book as a whole, and how do the characters Esther and Mordecai relate to the story? So it kind of gives us a jump start on, you know, interpreting that book.
It does. And when I looked at that really closely, you know, the divisions of Esther, I really discovered, I suppose, that we could argue who's the main character. Is it Mordecai or Esther? But Ahasuerus, the king, actually, is actually quite a strong candidate as to the main character of the book, and we don't often even consider that. So this is paratext here. The divisions within the book, maybe particularly, really helping us to kind of think about now, you know, who's really doing stuff in this book? Who's the main character of the book? Because that's often an important guide as to what a book is about.
Yeah, you mentioned too some of the, when you're thinking about the shape of the book, a little book like Ruth, the chapter divisions, where you get a couple of the, at the very beginning of the chapter, it mentions Boaz and his role, and it's in some ways highlights that, but then that also gives Naomi some of the last words of those chapters as well. So, you know, thinking about the, in one sense, it's arbitrary where we put those chapter titles, but as readers, we're automatically geared to think that something new or something important is, or some shift has happened, when internally the shift might be somewhere else, or maybe it is a perfect break, but it's something definitely that we have, it creates that effect.
Yes, it's interesting there where, and I kind of thought about that. Who's the main character of the book of Ruth? None of those divisions, those chapter divisions, particularly highlight Ruth herself. Yes, it's either Boaz or Naomi. So there's more than one person really involved, and you know that God is working in, what God is working through in that book. So paratext just really assists us in wrestling with, you know, often what are key issues in the interpretation of a book. And it's always good to have some of these things to tussle with in our mind, because it really sharpens us and helps us to notice things in the text. As you and I are chatting, we're talking about, what do we do with paratext? How does it influence, you know, do we accept it? Do we push back? Remembering, we're not confusing text and paratext. So none of this is questioning the text of Scripture.
Right.
But it's really this interpretation which kind of lies alongside Scripture here in the paratext. That's what we're wrestling with here.
Mm-hmm. And it also gives, with this noticing these features, it gives a, like almost, it's also like a pedagogical tool for us as readers. One of the ones you mentioned a few times throughout the book is the title of the book of Acts. Calling it Acts immediately prompts the question of the Acts of who? The Acts of the Apostles, the Holy Spirit, or the continuing activity of the risen Christ, or Paul versus the Jerusalem Apostles. The title itself kind of creates this question about, well, how are the apostles portrayed and whose actions are being highlighted? I thought that was an interesting effect.
So as we're seeing it kind of, this whole issue ranges over the two testaments, which is one reason I like it. It enables me as an Old Testament person mainly to kind of venture into the New Testament. You know, like the Old Testament's so much bigger than the New Testament, but I still want more. You know what I mean? I still want to venture into the New Testament as well. And Acts, and often ancient books which are called Acts were focusing on one character. But here's a book which kind of is wider than that, isn't it? The book of Acts, yeah, Paul is really important or featured strongly, isn't it? He's the focus from chapter 13 onwards. But John and Peter in the early chapters are much more important. So here's a title in some ways which doesn't quite fit the book, but that doesn't mean we just simply reject it. We start playing around with the idea. We start playing around with what's happening here. And again, it really leads us into the book. What is this book all about, and what might be the message of the book of Acts? And it is the part of the point of the book of Acts is, like, there's a whole lot of people involved, particularly Peter, John, and James is there too, and Paul, but it's the one gospel, you know, the unity of the different early Christian leaders who've got the same gospel, and that probably is very important to the writer of Acts. The unity of the gospel mission. Yeah, so I think all this is really helpful in just really helping us to wrestle with Scripture.
Yeah, staying on Acts there, connecting the title with the text divisions, one of the ones you noticed as well just briefly is one of the key transition markers internally to the text is the progress of the word continued, but that's not any of the chapter verse breaks. So those major internal turning points happen within other major sections, which is an interesting feature as well.
That I gather that's more of a recent kind of discovery, isn't it? You know, more modern scholars looking at Acts see the importance of these statements about the progress of the word. And ancient readers, I suppose, were looking at other things. They were highlighting episodes. Different episodes. That tends to be most of the breaks are interested in that kind of stuff. So, yeah, so ancient readers and modern readers, we can to some extent be interested in different things, but we need each other because it's all of the above kind of is the approach, isn't it?
Right.
Each of these things has an import into trying to understand a rich book like Acts.
And that perspective on the paratextual features as well is something that you've mentioned in a variety of places and articles and in the book, this particular book, is that all of these paratextual features like titles or text divisions, oftentimes they help us, but sometimes they simultaneously hide things from us or misdirect. They emphasize one thing while downplaying something else. And one of the things that you've pointed out as well, especially when you're trying to think about book ordering or some of these other things based on themes, recognizing that the biblical books are rich compositions so that they actually, by design, are capable of being emphasized in different ways. So just highlighting on one particular rendering or one particular meaning or interpretation might show us something that's real and be real helpful, but it also is likely hiding something as well.
Yeah, the divisions, yeah, which obscure things as well as highlight things. That's right. And because of that role of hiding stuff, we don't tend to notice that effect. I argue that things which are placed kind of in the middle of divisions aren't highlighted in the way that things are at the beginning and the end of a section of text, for example. But also titles, you know, one title can't say everything. Books have different themes. Books have different characters. So it's not a fault, you know, that one title is chosen, not another. Our choices have to be made. But that's where the role of paratext is to stimulate our thinking, you know, provide alternatives. We're allowed to think of other alternatives, all in this process of trying to understand the scriptures better. So we're not going to find fault with these divisions. And sometimes people, a division, for example, might look like it's in a crazy place. Genesis 2 verse 1, it separates off the seventh day from the previous six. Now, people have often seen that as some kind of weird mistake, or is it an exegetical insight? Because the seventh day is very different from the previous six. God isn't creating. You know, God is ceasing, there's rest. And I would actually see that as an insight. That the Sabbath rest of the seventh day is then filled out in the rest of chapter two with, you know, Eden.
Right.
And so I'd be almost suggesting there's an exegetical insight there, Seventh Day and Eden. So, yeah, before we rush in and kind of quickly dismiss anything, first of all, we've got to try to think about what the logic might be and is there some kind of, you know, germ of truth there that we can do something with?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something that we as readers sometimes just fly right over and not think about. So it's helpful to see some of those specific examples where it, on the one hand, it could be seen as busting something up or destroying some sort of flow of thought, but it could also be not completely arbitrary, but be trying to show us something that's actually there as well.
And often preachers in sermons, and I'm not going to criticize preachers, it's a hard job, but often we only point out a chapter division when we're going to criticize it. Oh, what a silly place to put a chapter division. Yeah. I hear that kind of stuff. I don't tend to hear the opposite. Hey, this is genius. What a great spot to put the chapter division. Mm-hmm. Do you notice what that's doing? So we tend to, you know, we tend to be pretty down on our chapter divisions and not realize that, but sometimes they surprise us, but that could be a good thing. There might be an insight there that we can tap into.
Well, and that's something that I've appreciated by research that you've done as well in this scholarly area as well, because sometimes we make the observation that our modern English chapter breaks are late, very recent additions, but then neglect the fact that the idea of text divisions or navigating or making sense of the big blocks of text in some way, well, these are ancient practices. They're not always the same, but you start to see paragraph breaking and these technological innovations to help read. These are in the ancient manuscripts as well. Obviously, they're different than the ones that sometimes we have here, but it's definitely something part of the reception of reading and rereading these texts.
Well, that was something that, you know, my teachers back in the day when I was a theological student never told me, you know, because we're using, you know, the modern scholarly Greek, you know, volumes that students use, but they don't tell us about the ancient paragraph divisions. Yes, all ancient texts were divided up in various ways. And, it's only something in more recent years that we've really begun to give attention to. Mm-hmm. So it's an exciting new area, and that's why you and I are kind of so interested in this kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, and for just a casual reader, to once you recognize or once you kind of see it as a tool, then you can kind of either make use of these aids or question them, as we've been talking about. I read a translation that had put the heading that they had for Matthew 1 was historical background, and then the story started, you know, halfway through the chapter or the other, and I just thought there's so much richness in the opening section of Matthew, what he's doing, to just relegate it to historical background already predisposed me to think about that, or a reader to think about that material in a particular way. Things that you need to kind of rush through to get to the story. But if you called it something like the whole counsel of God's revelation in the Old Testament, well, you kind of see it differently, right, than just historical background or something.
The whole of the Old Testament leads up to Jesus. Yeah, that would give a different impression. One illustration I use in classes when I'm doing Samuel, you know, the NIV heading for 1 Samuel chapter 12, they're caught out because they call it Samuel's farewell speech. Well, everyone thought they were turning up to hear Samuel's farewell speech, but his point is, I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to hang around and be a nuisance. In a sense, you know, that particular chapter heading is kind of leading the reader in the wrong direction. So some of the modern headings that we give our different chapters, not wrong, of course, it's paratext, very obviously so, But sometimes, yes, we can be misdirected. And so that's an example where modern editors of the Bible have been kind of caught out in a sense.
Yeah. Well, when you were researching and putting together this book and some of the articles that that you draw on in this book, what are some, we've already been talking about several examples, but is there in your research anything that ever surprised you, or maybe a favorite paratextual feature example?
Well, I love the Book of Ruth. I wrote a volume in the NSBT series with Peter Lau on Ruth. He invited me to be involved in that process. I love the Book of Ruth. And yeah, the three positions that Ruth is in just throw so much insight into this book. Now, we love the Book of Ruth. I dedicated that book to my three daughters, you know, like, but Ruth, you know, we're familiar with it after Judges, which leads to a messianic reading because it's very obviously preparing for David and then in the Bible timeline, including Matthew chapter 1 and its genealogy. So that lends us to the David link is highlighted by putting it after Judges and before Samuel. So it's a messianic reading. In Hebrew Bibles, often straight after the woman of worth in Proverbs. So that's wisdom. That's Ruth from a wisdom kind of perspective. So Ruth becomes more obviously a godly model for the reader to learn from. And the third position we're not so much familiar with from the Talmud, the listing, placing Ruth just before Psalms. And what I've seen there is how Ruth, the godliness of Ruth, anticipates the kind of piety that we see in David. You know, David, who's always in trouble, David, who's mostly, writing Psalms on a bad day, but he takes refuge in God, which is the very kind of thing that Ruth does explicitly. You know, Boaz comments on that in chapter 2, that she's taking refuge in God. So there we've got the piety of the Psalter anticipated in the ancestress of David. And so that is a different reading. So we've got this one book of Ruth. It's not a big book, but it's incredibly rich. Everybody knows that, and it's been endlessly studied. But when we look at paratext book order, it is presenting three quite different, of course not contradictory, but three quite different ways of approaching the Book of Ruth, and all that just really enriches our reading of this literary gem, which is Ruth, even more. So that's an example. That's one example I make use of, and yeah,
because part of your point is that the meaning that you're drawing out in those different ways is there in the Book of Ruth, but the arrangements help you see it. Shed different type of light on it, so you're able to approach it in a different way.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. So the whole aim is to interpret the text, you know, paratext, they're reader's aids, exactly. Mm-hmm. So that's the whole purpose of us looking at these things, yeah.
That's a good example of, like, book-level arrangement. This also has some implications, as we've kind of mentioned before, for specific exegesis of particular passages. One of the ones you mentioned in the New Testament section is if you just take the James 2 discussion of faith and works, you just take the paragraph break there, it might be a lot easier for you to see it as in tension with or contradictory to Paul's discussion of faith and works. But if you allow that discussion to be part of the broader movement of chapter 2, the whole chapter, then that doesn't solve all the exegetical riddles, but it definitely gives you some different tools, a different framework to come at seeing that as part of the pursuit of wisdom, and thinking about James's discussion of faith and works in light of the flow of thought in James. So I thought that was another interesting just quick example of, if you limit the paragraph too closely and then focus on specific details, oftentimes it is a design, the paragraph breaks or the sections are actually designed to help you coordinate them with the paragraphs around them.
Yes, and when you do that, yes, when you're connecting that passage with what goes just before, you know, at the end of our chapter one, those verses there, then you're very much linking in faith and works to the kind of whole social ethic, the charity kind of focus that James has. You know, he's not really trying to, interact with the Apostle Paul about, or certainly not questioning, you know, the Apostle Paul's discussions of faith and work, so forth. No, James seems to be on about something quite different there. Focusing on just a few verses, not really looking at the wider context, has really skewed a lot of discussion, hasn't it, of James versus Paul, so to speak. I looked at some of the ancient Bibles, Alexandrinus, Sinaiticus, Vaticanus, and just looked at how they were breaking up the text. And even though there's a bit of variety there, but where that variety kind of overlaps, yes, people are basically looking at a larger section of text there. And so, interpreting the verses in context and, with James's other concerns, his concern is certainly not to correct the Apostle Paul or try to address some distortion, as he might see, of Pauline theology. But that's often where scholars have gone. But when you look at paratext, it's not really suggesting that we frame the interpretive issues in that kind of way. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, this kind of relates to some of your other major interests in biblical theology and just biblical studies of biblical books, like Ezra Nehemiah, your commentary there, or your work on Ruth. You also recently came out with co-authored a book on biblical theology with Crossway. So just we could do this section a little more overview fashion. But how do you approach the discipline of biblical theology, maybe in this book and just more broadly? And how do you see your work in like paratext and some of the things we've been talking about, like in canon studies? How do you think that informs the discipline and the task of biblical theology?
Yeah, now this was a wonderful project that I had with Andreas Kostenberger. Andreas invited me and he and I were both interested in this, but we knew that we couldn't do it by ourselves. So we kind of banded together to write biblical theology. And we very much were similar in our thinking. Biblical theology, the theology of the Bible writers themselves, which you only really discover by a sustained reading and studying of all the various texts. And so we certainly wanted a biblical theology which was much more strongly exegetically based than biblical theology is. Sometimes biblical theology, it's awfully high level. You're kind of flying well above the text, looking for lovely patterns, but you don't land very often. And so biblical theologies can sometimes be quite exegetically unconvincing. You know, maybe I'm being a hard marker, but that's often what I've thought. So we wanted to write something with lots of exegesis, but also a biblical theology with lots of ethics. Because biblical theology is God's truth and God's will. You know, it's not just about what we believe, but it's about how we live. So that's a difference here. We've got a biblical theology with a lot of ethics. And also we wanted every Bible voice to be heard. And so we disciplined ourselves to kind of look at every book and allow every Bible book to have some input into biblical theology. And we've got a thematic emphasis, but we didn't want to focus just on one theme. And that's often been a problem. You can make too much of a theme. And because I'm from a Reformed background, I'm allowed to say this. Sometimes people make too much of covenant, for example. Mm-hmm. Awfully important, but covenant can't do everything. So sometimes people have made one theme do too much heavy lifting, try to get something from it that's not capable of providing. So there are a few distinctives in our approach, but I think they were good distinctives. Or we'll see what other people might think in this regard. But and in terms of paratext, yes, it's probably the first biblical theology which has really taken account of things like book order and book division and so forth like that. And Andreas was really keen on all this kind of things as well. So we're not just thinking of biblical theology in terms of the storyline of Scripture. We've got that. But another way of framing the whole thing, for example, is in terms of biblical book order. And biblical book order is in a sense an ancient form of biblical theology, because ancient readers are looking at a book. Oh, what are its main themes? Or what's this book on about? Where's the appropriate place for this book in the lineup of biblical mm-hmm. books? When ancient readers are doing that, they're kind of doing biblical theology. So it seems crazy not to get some of that input into what we're doing when we're trying to frame the biblical theology. Yes, so this is really the first volume that seriously takes into consideration biblical book order, book titles, book divisions. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think there was lots of new things, I think, in this biblical theology. And it was such a pleasurable experience, you know, working with Andreas. You know, I mean, like, it was just, I really enjoyed the process from beginning to end. And we both kind of got a lot out of it, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. And I like the comments you were making here about collection and canonical arrangement being an early form of biblical theology, in the sense of, in order to think about the relationship between two books, you really have to have a working knowledge of what that book is about. And so thinking about what is the appropriateness of it being in one location or the other, it forces you to think in broader terms, but also you still have to be rooted in the exegesis of that biblical book as a whole. I like that emphasis that that you're describing here as well, of unity and diversity, and then also the focus on a collection of central themes and not only a center or one overarching theme. I'm stuck on this as well. It's like staring into the fire or staring into a particular a light, and then looking up and you kind of see it everywhere. It's kind of natural. So you have to have some method in place to help you work through both unity and diversity.
The Bible has both, isn't it? In biblical theology, you're synthesizing. You're trying to make connections, but of course, it's possible to synthesize too much. You end up just blending everything into kind of like a soup type thing. So you've got to resist that. Mm-hmm. There's a balance there. And maybe also that is part of the helpfulness of having a co-author, where you're keeping each other honest mm-hmm. in various ways. We didn't find that very often at all that we had to say, oh, could you adjust this or what about that? Of course, you know, we were helping each other in the writing process, but because we were just really trying to, what the Bible itself saying, you know, what are the biblical authors themselves saying? Mm-hmm. We didn't at all feel that we needed to bring in a whole lot from our different traditions, our different church traditions, to kind of obscure that. So it really was a very healthy process for us both. You know, we both found a very refreshing. And we loved what we discovered as we were seeking to write this biblical theology.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a few examples too of the connection between like the study of canon or the shape of a biblical book, and then the way that you would describe the biblical theology themes of that book. A few examples that you mentioned from the Book of the Twelve, I thought were real instructive. The way that the first three chapters of Hosea are a perfect introduction to the book of Hosea, but also function as kind of like a lens through which to see all 12 of the minor prophets.
Yeah, that was an insight of Paul House that I made use of. Malachi, both books very heavily influenced by Deuteronomy and so forth, because they're very specifically, so providing a Deuteronomic frame for the book of the 12. So all that, again, is biblical theology. Mm-hmm.
And some books as well produce pretty radically different messages depending on which backdrop you place them against. So one of the ones you mentioned here is also the book of Jonah, thinking about the message of Jonah will continue to baffle interpreters unless they are willing to consider canonical context as well as the historical context.
Well, that's right. The endless discussions, what's the message of Jonah, you know, and also why does Jonah run away? And I'm one who says the book actually doesn't tell us. It never actually says what Jonah's problem was. I don't believe he's just anti-Gentile and so forth. So, yes, reading Jonah in context, you know, Obadiah before and Micah afterwards, and I very much saw an eschatological kind of context there. My own suggestion was that what's wrong with Jonah is that God's supposed to have mercy on the Gentiles, you know, at the end of time, you know. That's when the Gentiles will come in. Like, hey, all this is happening too early. It's not supposed to happen now. So I saw Jonah's problem in that kind of area. But certainly that's an example, yes. We come to agreement about what the message of the book is about if we keep ignoring its canonical placement, which has largely, not totally, of course, but largely been ignored in all these discussions as to the meaning of the book. We really need to notice where Jonah is in the lineup of biblical books in the Book of the 12.
Okay. Well, we've talked about a few of your major projects, but listeners will have some questions about just the writing process. So you've written in a variety of disciplines, published a host of journal articles and monographs. So what would you say are some of the strategies that you individually use in writing? Like, how do you keep that output up? Or is there a particular process that you work through for a given project?
Well, Chad, as you know, never be in a hurry. So we're just kind of working away at things. So just a few little maxims in this kind of area. You know, use what little time you have. You know, sometimes people think, oh, I'll wait until I've got 3 weeks or something like that, or I'll wait for the summer holidays. Hey, you probably need a holiday in the summer holidays. So don't wait until you've kind of got time to write. You've got to just take all the little bits of time that you have. And I've got a bit of a pattern to my week because I live in one city and I work in another. So, you know, I mean, there's an hour's flight between Melbourne and Sydney. I live in Melbourne, work in Sydney. Now, I make that work for me because I tend to be home Monday and Friday. So Monday, when I'm feeling kind of fresh, that's my writing day. Friday, when I'm back home and exhausted, well, I just kind of finish off admin type stuff. So think about the rhythm of your week and try to carve out a day that you can just do things. So regularly getting back to writing is really important. And also writing articles, writing books, we've got to beware of perfectionism. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you can get into thinking, oh, this journal article is never good enough quite to send off for review. Just send it off and see what someone else says.
Yeah.
And we're not to be discouraged about rejection because that's just a fact of life. So, you know, we all hate feedback, but we need feedback. So if people have reviewed your stuff, well, take notice of what they say, fix it up quickly, send it somewhere else. We need to try to be less affected by, you know, the process, the rejection kind of process. And that's where I very much believe we should encourage and help others and celebrate the achievements of others. You know, when people I know, you know, write something, I often kind of just flick an email, hey, I noticed, that's great. Because as you know, Chad, you know, you don't get much of that in the meantime of people saying, hey, great job, great to see the book's finally out or this article, or, and it makes you feel good too, you know what I mean? So we're really not competing with other people who are writing. We need to kind of, you know, be generous. And also don't listen to that voice in your head which says it's no good, you know. We're full of self-doubts, you know, we're our own harshest critic. Just don't listen to that voice, don't feed that voice. And I suppose also don't wait for inspiration, just start writing. You know, I tell my students, start writing that essay or assignment. The first time you read anything at all, I want to see you writing that essay. And it's the same with writing a journal article or a book. You're not waiting for inspiration, just start writing. because, you know, with all our modern computers, we just endlessly edit and re-edit and so forth like that. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing worse than a blank page. That's one of my sayings too. So get rid of that blank page. Fill that blank page. Don't worry about the quality. Don't worry about the content. So I suppose basically what I'm saying is don't let anything hold you back. You know, just use what little stuff you've got. Don't listen to all those self-doubts. Don't worry about quality to start with. Quality will come as you keep working on this topic area. And really, these kind of things are just common to people who write generally. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not about academic writing, but how do novelists and other people write stuff?
Right.
This is really what people do, I suggest. Yeah.
Yeah, that's all really helpful. I'll probably listen to that back a few times because I have a tendency of, getting an idea, putting it down on paper, and then, you know, stewing on it for a couple months and then coming back to it. So that was very good. Very good.
Well, you're allowed to stew on an idea as long as you're writing something else at the same time. So you do that. Sometimes I just write an idea, right? I've got a file name. I haven't written anything. It's probably not the right time to write on this, but I've had this idea, so I write it down before I forget it. But make sure you're always writing something. And it's like life generally. All these little things, they really do add up. Yeah.
Well, that's very helpful. Well, as we finish here our discussion time, I like to ask a more general reflective question. There's a lot going on in our world that's discouraging, but what is something you've experienced or reflected upon recently that gives you hope?
God's kingdom is going to break in, you know what I mean? So Christ is going to return. We need to believe that, and we need to kind of faithfully keep working and serving in that light. So we need to get out of our Christian bunker. If we're in some kind of Christian bunker, we need to kind of keep being involved in wider society. North America, Australia, you know, we're very different, but we're both in challenging situations at the moment, and there is the danger that we kind of get discouraged and we kind of withdraw. I don't believe we need to. There still are fellow travellers out there, you know, who maybe aren't even believers, but, you know, there's other people who are interested and passionate about some of the same things that we're on about. Let's find those fellow travellers. Let's keep being willing to work with people who don't agree with us and everything. And there still are influential believers in many organisations, government and business and so forth. In other words, I really do believe our situation is really quite fluid, and I don't believe we should lose hope. And I'm also a great believer. I'm in a stage of life where my job is to help everybody else get a good job. You know what I mean? Like, I don't need a promotion. I don't need, you know, but other people do. So I really am trying to encourage the young ones rather than discourage them. I'm not going to spend my time telling them, oh, it's awfully dark out there in the world. And I'm really doing quite the reverse. I'm not denying the challenges, but there's a rising younger generation who will achieve even more than, Chad, you know, our generation. We've got to believe that. God's still on his throne. So I don't think it's our role to discourage people. Quite the reverse, and I spend a lot of my time trying to give young people a leg up in various ways, you know, try to encourage and mentor those who are younger. And, yeah, we've got older, wiser heads, of course, but I love the enthusiasm of the young, and we don't have to kind of, you know, puncture their balloons and kind of think they're naive or something like that. Yeah, so I really am quite positive about the future. I by no means believe that everything is necessarily just going to keep sliding the way we are seeing it. Mm-hmm. I don't want a kind of adversarial kind of stance with wider society. I think we just insistently but graciously uphold Christian truth, Christian values. But I don't think we have to kind of get defensive or narky about it. And I do believe, too, that the main apologetic we need today is to answer the so what question. People are rejecting the Christian faith, I think not so much because, oh, they don't believe it's true. The issue isn't so much did Jesus rise from the dead. Of course, that's a central issue, of course. But people are saying, so what? Like, how does that really connect to my daily life? So we've got to answer the so what question. Another reason we wanted a lot of ethics in our biblical theology. The Christian faith makes a difference. It still makes a difference. Jesus is still in the business of turning people's lives around. So it's that so what aspect of apologetics. I think that has to be our focus now, rather than maybe apologetics as we have traditionally always thought about it. So there are a few thoughts. So as you can see, I'm more an optimist than a pessimist. Like, we all have our down days. Of course we do. But I don't think we're to get into that. I'm sure we're not meant to get into that.
Sure. Yeah, that's a very hopeful perspective. And it's also a great exhortation for us to all strive to, for sure. Well, thank you for joining us today. Your work on canon and the paratextual features of the Bible have been a great help to me and encouragement to me in many ways for a long time. So very much appreciated.
No, thank you, Chad. It's wonderful to finally have a conversation with you, and I trust we'll one day have a conversation face to face. That'd be lovely.
Yeah.
God bless you.